Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we will explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140 plus years of football history and memorabilia. Now you can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. We're sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for one of the largest selections of football cards and football memorabilia in North America. Their website, MSBSportsCards.com. And by BST Auctions. Check out their website at BSTAuctions.com for the latest in all their new auction activity that will be happening soon. Welcome to the all-new 2017 season of podcasts of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And to give our new listeners some background on our show, we broadcast 48 shows from the time period of December 2011 to February 2014 on the Leatherheads of the Gridiron Network. And now we are back. And now he is back, my co-host. And I'd like to introduce him. He is a contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine. He's a football memorabilia historian that specializes in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. He is the one. He is the only. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome back and welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, so good to hear your voice. So good to hear your football introduction again. I was smiling through that whole thing, just trying to keep from laughing into the microphone. So good to be back, sir.
I think I drove Brenda crazy today because I practiced it about four or five times in the house, and you could hear me pretty much from one end of the house to the other. But anyway,
the minute you threw it out there, back, I was like, we were working on a Bob Swick football ringtone at one point, weren't we?
We are back, and we are back with a brand new 2017 season. And to fill in our listeners also on what we're doing, we're going to be broadcasting two shows per month through 2017. It may increase at different times of the year. We don't we have to see how it goes. And we will have a guest in the middle of the show like we used to have. And now it's time for what Joe and I and many of our longtime listeners know is our talk about different things in the hobby, so on and so forth. And we're going to start off tonight, Joe. 2014 was the last show we did, and I know we talked and conversed via email on and off over the past few years. And I want to talk a little bit about what, in your mind, has changed in the hobby since we last talked. Now, we're going to look at a period of roughly 2014 up to today, What's changed? Give me some feedback. Give me some ideas. Give me your views on the West Coast there. What's going on?
First of all, again, love the show. Happy to be back. So thank you. Thank you, Captain, our ambassador of football, for putting this together again. And
you're quite
welcome.
I will
point out the obvious.
I really missed our conversations, I got to say that.
Yeah, exactly. I've said it before. I'll say it 100 times during the upcoming shows. I've got the best seat in the house, sitting down for an hour every couple weeks talking to the ambassador of football, Bob Swick. So I'll go for the obvious. What to me has changed in the hobby is the awareness of high-end football between 14 and now. Prices. The prices. I mean, take for example, the stalwarts of the rookie cards, Joe Namath. Joe Namath rookie card, I can remember buying PSA 8 for $5,000 to $6,000. This was, 2011, 12, 13. $5,000 to $6,000 is pretty much the price for a Joe Namath rookie card.
Okay.
At some point, it hit $10,000, $12,000. It's in the mid-20 range now. $22,000 to $25,000 is the going price for a Joe Namath rookie card. So the price for that one card alone has gone up five times in the last 2.5 years. So
all right. Well,
there's
I
no
ask,
awareness.
I got to ask you point blank on the Namath card. You think it's an actual movement by collectors who are demanding that card, or you think it's a bubble?
To me, it's a bubble. To me, there are it's always been, the hobby is and always will be discretionary cash. If you're having a hard time putting food on the table, you're not buying football cards. You're not buying collectibles. If your job is going well, if you've got money flowing in, if things are good, the stock market's up, you've got a little extra cash, it's time to wax a little nostalgia and go buy that card that reminds you of your youth. I mean, that to me is what the hobby's about, is every time I look at a card, it reminds me of some point in my youth, except obviously the Namath card. I mean, that's you remember opening those packs. That's more
your
line.
Yeah. And again, I look at the 65 Namath card. A card that I got out of a pack when I was a kid, when I was 7 years old. And I'm saying to myself, okay, now as many of our listeners may or may not know, and any new listeners don't know this, I'm not big on graded cards. The only graded cards I have in my collection, as everyone knows, are the Mayo Cut Plugs, which are SCD graded because I like the background of them, the way they put them in the holders. But I'm not a big fan on graded cards in any way, shape, or form. But, you bring up a good point that, okay, if I take my non-pristine Joe Namath rookie card that I've had in my hands, for the past, 50-some-odd years, and I then take him and I encapsulate him for the rest of his day and my days, am I a wise collector to grade my card, or am I actually not being the true collector that I've always been, as to, I keep everything in 9-pocket or 6-pocket sheets or 8-pocket sheets. I'm not looking. I like looking at my cards, and I know we talked about this one time, a long time ago. The big investment that people should have made 10 years ago was buying stock in these plastic companies that produce all these graded slabs because, I go to any show today, and I see, hundreds of thousands of pounds of plastic with the card in the middle of it and all these incredible different figures, numerical grading and so on and so forth, one of ones, yada, yada, yada.
The subjectivity of grading.
And that's the other big thing. And I look at my mails, and again, we talked about this before, I got 20 graded 20 and 30s, which should be 40s and 50s, and I got 30s. I got a 40 that should be a 10. So it makes no sense to me, after a while. I'm gonna tie in this with a quick story. This morning I went to a local card show here in town over from where we live, and it was very, very quiet, very few dealers. So it's more of a neighborhood type of show, and literally every dealer had the wads of the graded cards every which way on their tables.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking at kids teenagers are picking up the graded cards, newer graded cards, and they're starting to negotiate on the price on them. And I'm just like, you know, my mouth drops. I mean, here it is. A kid is going to drop $30 for a graded card instead of buying a box of cards and just, you know, having some fun and opening up the packs. You know what I mean?
Opening up a wax pack,
and,
yeah.
And it blows my mind. That's
how you and I were both.
Go ahead.
You and I were both raised that way. I mean, I got into the hobby by opening wax packs. So did you. And it's kind of a shame the hobby's getting away from that.
And I'm also going to tie it into something that I've seen, I'm sure you've seen out there, is these now pack rip box break tables and broadcasts and podcasts and TV shows, on and on and on. So I'm saying to myself, okay, a lot of these kids are learning from that, and my experience this past summer at the National Convention in Atlantic City, when you walked into the convention, literally one-third of the convention was all pack rips and box breaks. And at the end of the day, if they didn't find cards they liked, the cards were in the wastebasket. And I was real tempted to start the garbage pick, and I'm saying, no, I'm not going to do it. But I'm saying, how many kids in a hospital or whatever would give anything to see a card like that? And here they are discarded out of the hospital. So how are you creating any collectors out of that? You know what I mean?
I'll add an anecdote to that. My son, who just turned 8, is obviously a huge Steve Largent fan.
Right.
But
should be.
Recently, for some reason, he's gotten into Odell Beckham Jr., which I'm good with. He's in the hobby. So.
Yep. Yeah.
So my for Christmas, he wore his naturally his Steve Largent jersey over to my mother-in-law's house for Christmas, and at some point my wife's brother gives him an Odell Beckham Jr. jersey, and to my horror, my son opens it, takes off his Steve Largent Hall of Fame jersey, and puts on his Odell Beckham jersey. I know.
Ouch.
Well, fast forward his birthdays. I'm okay with that. He's keeping it in a football family. Fast forwarded a couple weeks, his birthday's there, and I give him about 10 wax packs of. I just went into Target and picked up the closest wax packs, and I haven't ripped wax. I don't know who the cool ones are, but I just gave him 10 wax packs, and he opened them and loved them and found an Odell Beckham Jr. card, which he covets. So I ran downstairs, got him some top loaders, so he could put the top 10 favorite football cards in the top loader. And he rubber banded them, put them in his lunch pail, took them to school. So, to me, that's how you create future collectors.
Now, you got to promise me, and you got to talk to him and tell him you don't want to see that card go out to grading anytime soon. First or second grade kid. With this PSA graded Beckham card in school, and they're trying to slop
you've
it
rubbed
at
off on me, Captain. I've started to get away from graded cards, so I have. But That one card is an example of the hobby. What's changed in the hobby to me? So to me, there's an awareness. There's a new pack of collectors. I mean, you've got a Robert Caster line who comes along who starts scarfing up. Rare and very high end. He's the new Mosh. He's the new, he's the new Fight for Old DC on steroids because he's scarfing up everything. And good on him. He's good for the hobby. I've spoken to Robert Castellan. He's good for the hobby because, he opened up a museum to display all these things rather than stuffing them in a room and not posting scans up or anything like that.
Well, the one thing, again, I go back to graded cards, and I talked to several people at the National about it, and they understood what I was saying. I said, okay, so we got all these pack rips here, and I see all the young kids are hanging out there, and they get their one card. So I'm saying to myself, so in the future, the sets are immaterial, but we're going to have great collections formed of one or two cards, and then when the player falls out of the play, so what happens? So there's a new one or two card great collection. That's the part that scares me about the hobby, because again, you look at a kid is overwhelmed when he goes to a Target or whatever, or a card shop. There's 24 different types of Panini 2016 cards. There's no more tops.
Yes, for one player.
There's an exclusive now by Panini. So they control the market. So basically, it is in theory an oligopoly controlling the market. And at the same time, however, they're not, you know, nurturing set collectors of any way, shape, or form. And somebody like me, you know, old school, I didn't buy one pack of 2016 this past season for the simple reason Topps wasn't there. And I'm not going to, you know, I couldn't even figure out what the low-end brand was of Panini, so I said, back with it. I'm not collecting it. I'm complete through 2015. Yeah. I'm not going to sweat it. I'm not going to lose sleep over it. You know,
I've always felt bad for the kid collectors now, because I know there is one Steve Largent rookie card, the Topps 1977 number 177 card. That's it. There's no dispute. There's no argument. What is Odell Beckham Jr.'s rookie card? There's probably 30 or 40 or maybe even 100. Who knows? Cards that came out of his rookie season. I mean, and that's where it starts to get a little ridiculous. So, you know, so the future of rookie cards, the future of master sets, the future of basic sets might be in trouble. Like you said, and it's nearly impossible to put together a set, because which set do you choose? I mean, you know,
and again,
the Panini Gold, the Panini Leaf, the Panini,
And again, I look back at, there were a lot of collectors back in the early 80s, and we had our Beckett books, and Beckett basically did the football cards along with the basketball and the hockey cards. And I knew several guys who said, well, I'm collecting all the football in the book. And you know what? They were probably in many cases 70-80% complete on most of their sets, because it wasn't 35 sets out in one season to try to collect anything. You had maybe at the most a half a dozen because you had food issues or whatever. Or when you had all the food sets start coming out, that was some fun because you actually got to see a team set published or printed by that that team through the the police organization or whatever it was. And that was cool to see. You got some different you got different players on the cards, you got different photos on the cards. It was neat. It was a fun time. But then again, you go to the explosion with Pro Set, and then 89 up, forget it. You know, to me it really, there's so much stuff out there we don't even know what it is.
If you are a collector, at some point you are kind of a completionist. There's something mentally wrong with all of us. We collect pictures of men in tights on cardboard. So at the base of it, there's something wrong with all of us. We're collectors. I mean, different people have different addictions. Some people smoke, some people drink. We collect. I've always loved collecting. I've always explained it to people as I know that in the 1950 Bowman set, there are 144 cards. And I know who the players are, and I know how many there are. And I know how many cards I have, and I know how many cards I have to complete it. And when I'm done, I'm done. I'm a completionist. If you're a collector, you're likely a completionist. And nowadays, I feel like a lot of people who are collectors can't complete either a team set, a player set, or a set. So you're not itching that scratch, you know.
Scratching that itch. I'm seeing now in the market, especially for a lot of the older vintage collectors, they're collecting. They stop at 1988 Tops, because that's the last year, and that was the last year for Flair in action also. And they're saying, you know, I'm only collecting 48 to 88, or I'm only collecting 60 to 88 or whatever. I'm not doing anything prior to that, or I'm not going to do anything 89 up type of thing. And I understand where they're coming from. So, okay, now the issue is going to be in the long run, how do we nurture collectors so those pre-88 sets get turned over to the next generation of collectors? That's what I'm very worried about, to say the least, you know. And because of it, you know, what's going to happen in the future, anybody's guess. And I know I sound like a broken record sometimes, because I'm always saying, what are you doing to nurture the hobby? What are you doing to make the hobby move? What are you doing to bring new collectors in? I think it's a serious issue that all sport collecting has. Not just football, but, you know, baseball, basketball, and hockey cards also at the same time. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. One other comment I'm going to make about this past summer's national, I thought we were located in a pretty good part of the convention, that people would stop and look at the stuff, so on and so forth. But when the show opened in the morning, it was comical to watch the people running from the entrance to where all the autographed guests were. And then after all that was done, they would start to edge their way up ever so slowly. So basically you could sit there for 2 hours and either twiddle your thumbs or just keep moving all your stuff on your table over and over again. But again, you got a show of that size and an expense of that size, and yet most of the people that are coming through that door want that autograph, and that's what they go for, and they're in and out type of thing. So it's interesting. I think Chicago is different. Chicago's is going to be the national for the summer in July, but I think they're a different crowd. They're a different buying crowd than the East Coast. So it was kind of interesting to see what was going on there. Do you see any sets super hot, super cold? You mentioned the boom in the pristine star cards. Were you seeing anything with any set movement? Anything we should be aware of or not aware of? Or
you know, as always, I have an article that I've been working on for Gridiron Greats for like the past 4 years, which is just simply called "What Are the Most Popular Football Sets Manufactured?" So probably about 4 years ago, I took a snapshot of the top 20 collected sets. And I just went through the PSA registry, and I just saw how many people had a registered set of a certain year. And then a year later, I did it again, and a year later, I did it again, and I'm getting ready to do it again. So I'll have four data points showing, you know, the top sets and how they rise and fall. And without a doubt, the number one set is and always has been the 55 Tops All-American. And it's usually followed up by 57 Tops, 52 Bowman Large. You know, so, I mean, yeah, your 50s are your big ones. 55 Tops All-American is usually ahead by about 20% of any other set. So without a doubt, the number one collected set. I probably shouldn't get to the punchline of the article I'm getting ready to write, but, you know, that's the gist of it.
Okay, that's good. I see a lot of movement one way or the other with the early Bowmans. And again, the 52 Bowman Large is one set I have started and stopped so many times over the years, it's not even funny. And I get frustrated with it for a lot of different reasons. Number 144, which is a killer of a card.
Jim Lampard.
Yeah. Yep. And you know, and seeing now where some of the stars are ending up, it's truly amazing. And again, even trying to find them ungraded in lesser condition is starting to become a real challenge at the same time, which I find interesting. So I can speak from experience on that. I think there's always going to be a lot of demand for 55 All-American and both the 56 and 57 Tops sets. 57 set, especially because of all the rookies in it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's always going to be a hot.
You talk about the 52 Bowman set, and isn't it fun to collect that, though? Nobody's heard of Jim Lansford. I mean, unless you collect that set, unless you know. And I wrote an article several years ago on the 57 top set for Gridiron Greats. And in there, I ran through all my opening line, which I always take a lot of pride in, my preamble, I call it. You know, it's like Bart Starr, Johnny Unitas, Raymond Berry, Zeke Bratkowski. And it's like, who? Zeke who? If you don't collect the 57 set, or if you're not a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, you have no idea who Zeke Bratkowski is. And he is the rarest card in the 57 top set, other than obviously the checklist. But Jim Lansford, it is kind of interesting. You know, if you don't immerse yourself into a set, if you buy a complete set, or you know, then you'd never understand what the rare cards are. But Zeke Bratkowski, if you drop that name to somebody who collects the 57 set, the palm will go to their forehead and there'll be a long sigh. And that's what I love. That's what I love about immersing myself into a set is understanding. And then and then once I bought that uncut sheet for 57 tops, you know, Zeke was top left on the sheet, and I understand why he's such a rare card.
Right. Right. You know, it's funny you say on the 57 set, one set that I've collected, I put together, sold, traded numerous times over the years, is the 1960 top set. And for whatever reason, I've always been attracted to that set because the Johnny Unitas is out of focus on that one, and he's got his fruit cut. And it's just a classic number one card in that set. But in any event, I always tell people, you know, there's a lot of different cards in that set, in my opinion, that are really tough to find centered. And, you know, if you really want a pristine, near-mint set of that, good luck. You're going to be really going through a lot of cards to find them. And it is doable. But,
yes.
Johnny,
you were cross-eyed in that card, is what I was correcting him.
Yeah.
Johnny, you were cross-eyed in that card.
I remember back in the late 70s, early 80s, going to shows, and for whatever reason, that 1960 Tops, literally any dealer that was selling me their contraband cheese boxes for $5 full of football cards, inevitably, I would have at least a dozen 1960 Tops cards in that box. And I'm saying, wow, man, this is great. I started making the sets up. And, you know, to really date myself, I remember one of the first sets I sold of that was like $50, which was incredible money when I sold it. But, you know, over the years, I just see more and more that, you know, to me, I continue to love that set for all the different, for lack of a better term, the nuances in the set itself, because it's to me, so unique. And again, a strict NFL set when the AFL came out at the same time. So that's very interesting to me. All right, we're going to move along because right now I'd like to introduce our guest who has just called in. Our guest tonight is a senior contributing writer for Gridiron Greats magazine. He's written many articles for the magazine over the years. He is a football card and memorabilia historian with an extensive collection of Pittsburgh Steelers items. He's also a co-owner of both MSB Sports Cards and BSD Auctions. And I'd like to welcome tonight a familiar voice to our listeners, Mr. John Spanos. John, welcome to the show this evening.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Hey, Joe, what's going on? It's good to be back.
Hey.
Just listened for the last few minutes. I just got home and called in, and just good to hear your guys' voices again talking about football stuff. It's really refreshing and it's definitely needed in the hobby.
You know who Zeke Bratkowski is, right, John?
I do. I do know who Zeke Bratkowski is.
Hey, John, in your opinion, again, we were talking a little bit about it before you called in, and you're very, very active in the hobby between MSP Sports Cards and BSD Auctions and at shows and talking to collectors selling their collections. What changes have you seen in the market over the past few years, especially since when you started the business to today?
Well, it's cyclical for sure, and I'm sure you guys already cover this, and hopefully I kind of go along with what you were saying, but I guess if I don't, that's not a bad thing either. High-grade cards, PSA, high-grade cards from the sets.
Rookie cards.
For the registry and rookie cards and registry collectors. That stuff has gone bananas, and you know, it's interesting. I like to liken it to the trying to collect Mona Lisas, but even though there's multiple Mona Lisas, everybody wants the best one, and you have a number of collectors driving that market, and obviously with the collection that's at the Hall of Fame right now, it drew a lot of attention to that type of collecting, that style of collecting. And you definitely have to, you know, have the money to get into that fray. But at the same time, you can, you know, collect a set like I heard Joe talking about and go for eights and nines. But we constantly have people calling us and asking, do I have this, do I have that, do you have this and that grade? And it's typically, you know, eights and nines, and, you know, that's all I collect now, and I'm putting all my money there. And that's fine. I don't think that's bad for the hobby at all. It's just something that's driving the market currently, and I think probably PSA has a lot to do with that, just the bringing the competition into it and making it somewhat competitive. You know, I have the best this and best that. Like I said, that's fine. I would have to say 19th century material definitely always draws a lot of attention, and you know, you have your certain collectors that get into that, others that don't find it quite as interesting. And I've had people tell me this too, and I don't know any of these players, and not really interested in collecting them. But I think that's a matter of, you know, somebody's taste, and if they want to take the time to do the research and find out who Brinkthorn is or Hinky. But, you know, again, that's their prerogative. So again, those two areas, programs and tickets, always hot and have been since we started this, but just certain ones. You know, you could still pick up some really nice older tickets for less than $25. And I'm talking about stuff before World War II. But if you're looking for certain teams, certain games, they've hit five figures in some of the auctions lately. So just the program and the tickets. And you know, people know what they're looking for now. The hobby has definitely matured, no doubt about that.
Yeah, I said the same thing, John. I mean, it just seems like there's a more educated, sophisticated collector on the market now. You've got people who, you know, who put a lot of homework into what they collect rather than bouncing between things.
And yeah, that's a wise move, too. I mean, it really is.
I think what you're seeing, like you both say, the maturity of the hobby to me has really excelled, in my opinion, probably over the last 10 years or so. You probably even looking at a 5-year period, it's matured literally overnight. Because again, I still get from time to time people looking for particular things, so on and so forth. And talk about 20 years ago, you never saw that type of thing. You know what I mean? So I think that's a positive for the hobby at the same time. But I'm going to play devil's advocate. So, John, what do you think that means for, say, somebody's got, I don't know, a 1964 top set in, let's say, VGEX condition? Is it something they should just put in the recycling pail at the end of the day, or do you think there's still marketability for lesser-grade cards like that?
That's a good question.
First of all, that set disgusts me. All the little yellow stars and hearts around the perimeter. There are hearts, aren't there? Doesn't the second series have little red and pink hearts around the border?
They are pretty cards. That's not one of my favorites either. Definitely for the 60s as a number of classic sets. I don't think that one ranks up there. There are certain people that like it. But back to the question, I have a segment, a group of collectors that, you know, that I know, I include myself in this group, that is happy sitting around the mid-level, so to speak. And I know for the most part those cards aren't going to be altered. I know that, if I use my eye correctly and I can handle a little bit of, you know, rounding on the corners, that I'm going to have a card that has good eye appeal and it's going to be a fraction of the cost. So I don't think that's affected anything. I think my biggest concern with this whole market is kind of the hot potato mentality. You know, I've got the only nine, and then, you know, 2 years later you check the registry and there's four other nines on there. And, and I see a lot of that. I see people shuffling through their collections, going from one collection to another. I think, you know, check the population reports and go for the rarity, and it's probably not a bad move. But, you know, you have to be willing to accept the fact that, and I think this has already happened, you know, especially with baseball, that your nine that you may have paid, let's just say, for instance, $100 today, might only be worth $50 tomorrow.
That's just it might be.
So.
And that's a definite issue. I mean, that's something that really, really should concern people within the market. But at the same time, again, when you got the big pockets and you're going for everything, you know, and you're going for the best of the best, and you do it, especially in football, because it's such a smaller amount of cards as compared to baseball or, you know, or doing a run of tops from 52 up type of thing. So there's a difference between the two at the same time. But, again, I'm glad to hear that you're saying there is still a market for those mid-grade cards because, again, I fully agree with what you're saying that, you know, you can touch the cards, you can learn a lot from the cards, you can see the cards, you can hold them, you feel the history there. And I think that's what it's all about, you know what I mean? So
yeah, you can smell them too, right, Joe? That's important always. You got to be able to smell
them. Don't make fun of
it. I agree.
Don't make fun of
it. I agree. I'm not making fun of you because I just got a consignment in. It was a group of top sets from 1970 to 1979, and they were all ungraded, every single one, every single card. And I opened those boxes, and I swear whoever, and, you know, whether it was the person who consigned them or wherever he got them from, I don't think they'd let the wax wrappers. I mean, they've been out of the wax wrappers for all those years, but I think they've been in the box since then. They smelled like new cards. They had that top smell.
Oh, you're kidding.
The 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Real good. A neat smell, you know. It's kind of the cardboard and the wax and a little bit of gum left over. And I'm like, wow, these are 40-year-old cards, and they smell like my childhood, you know. That's what
I thought for sure you were going to go with. They smelled like smoke. I literally thought for sure you were going to be like, yeah, you can just smell the smoke.
I get those too sometimes. I can't tell you how many times I've left things sit out in my garage open to air out before I start doing anything with them, like put them in top loaders or anything. That's disappointing sometimes. But I get the smoky cards too.
You guys make fun of me, but I learned a long time ago, you smell a card, how it smells. I mean, if it smells chemically, I mean, you know, and the other embarrassing thing I brought in that article is, I mean, holding it up, you know, holding it up to your face, to your cheek or your lips to see, you know, if it's wet. I mean, from, you know, people, I hate to say it, there's some bad guys out there. There's some bad guys in the hobby, and they're one or two steps ahead of us collectors, us dumb collectors. So you got to, you know, that's one of the things.
No, I agree 100%, Joe. And I, as much as I was picking on you, I've been smelling cards for at least 40 years. So.
Well, when you say it like that, John, it sounds really weird.
It is. We all are weird, so I figure what we do.
Yeah, without a doubt. I love it. So, well, you've got Blaisdell's. He started trickling out Mike's collection. How was that? I mean, how'd that conversation get broached, John? I mean, just, you know, a collector. And it's funny, you know, Bob and I were talking about Mike. I mean, I've known Mike, you know, quite a few years. I met him at a card show in Seattle, and he had some 1976 Seahawks Fred Myers, you know, which is a local issue here in the Northwest. And just like, oh, good set. Have you seen this card? And everything I threw out, this guy, you know, just had a response for. And at the end, I'm just standing there, I'm like, who are you? I mean, it's like the opening scene of Princess Bride, where it's like, you know, I'm the Dread Pirate Roberts. I'm like, you know, who the hell are you? You know everything about this hobby. I mean, and over the years, I mean, Mike's just been that, you know, he's humble, first of all, which I really, really like, you know, and somebody, you know, he's gracious, he's open with his knowledge, he's that collector. And I just, sad to see him leave the hobby, but, you know, I think all of us get it. But, you know, how'd that conversation get broached?
Well, he's been at the National Party for the last 2 years. I've always invited him to share a booth with us, just to come in, even if he didn't want to sell anything, you know, just to hang out and talk, because I figured, as you said, this guy is the guy. You know, outside of Bob, him and Bob are the guys in my mind. So, you know, and just to talk to Mike was incredible. I mean, it really was. And at the National in 2015, it was in Chicago, I think. We were sitting on the couch talking, and he's like, you know what, I'm going to start divesting my collection. I almost fell off the couch. I'm like, why?
Wow.
No real reason. And it was the big reason being is that he was just at that stage in his life, and he wanted to downsize.
Yeah.
And he's kept some things. He did keep some things, and that's probably a topic for another time. But he's like, yeah, it's time for somebody else to enjoy these. You know, I've had my enjoyment out of them. It's been a good 30, 40 years or so, and I'm ready to move on. And I respect Mike for that. And I'm very happy, obviously, that he had that conversation with myself and Andy. And he made that comment at that point, and then we just went from there. So,
I assume Mike and Bob are top two, but somewhere in there I'm top five. But I mean, you know, you are the senior contributing writer. I'm just a contributing writer. I mean, you've got that title.
Well, you know, I think unfortunately it comes to pass in every collector's life, especially as you're getting older. Okay, what am I doing here? You know, I know Brenda's not going to take over the collection if I go first. And my daughter has absolutely no desire whatsoever to even look at anything I got. So I'm in a little quandary myself as I'm getting older, but also I'm not at the point where I want to liquidate certain things. There's certain parts of my collection that are me, and I'm probably going to keep them to the end. So it's a tough decision. And again, mm-hmm. you know, I'm glad Mike is doing it under his terms, which I think is important for any collector when they're selling a collection of his magnitude, which is so historically significant from the football card and memorabilia market. People got to realize that this to me is like a once in a lifetime collection coming out. And it just blows my mind, and it took me a long time to digest when, John, you told me first what was going on. I was literally in shock. I mean, I got off the phone with you, and I was just staring. I was just in shock. And, I understand, and in a way, I'm just saddened by the whole thing. But trying to look at it in a positive way, we're going to mm-hmm. see probably things that we haven't seen in the market for years. And I think that's a real positive for the hobby coming up, especially with some, giving the different collectors in our market an opportunity to bid on some very, very rare and historical pieces out of that collection. And it's just truly, truly amazing.
It's been an education.
Go ahead, John.
For me. I'm sorry. It's been an education for me because it's forcing me to learn some of the nuances of some of these issues. And Mike's collection is complete. That's the best way I can describe it. Comprehensive. But in addition, he has companion pieces. He has advertising mm-hmm. pieces. For every set, there's something else. You know, it's not just the 1960 set. It's a box. It's a wrapper. It's a wrapper that nobody's ever seen before. It's one of them.
So let's broach the mm-hmm. subject then, Mr. Spano. We've seen the curtain pulled back a little bit. We've caught a glimpse of what's in Mr. Blaisdell's collection. I've talked to Mike pretty extensively. He's posted a few things up and shared things for articles. And every once in a while, just throw something out. You're like, holy crap. I had no idea that even existed. Thank you. You don't mind if I put this in my article? And so, I mean, we've seen your first installment, in the auction. What do we have coming up? What's, what are some other fun things that we can expect to see in the next auction?
I think what has impressed me the most so far in this auction, and there's going to be plenty of football in this auction, in the March, early April when it starts. But the Oberlin candy, I didn't realize how rare they were. And if people listening aren't familiar with those, these are candy wrappers. They literally are paper thin, less than paper thin candy wrappers that were issued in the 30s and early 40s. And for a while, there were only a couple known in the hobby. And then I think the checklist is up to 5 now. I could be wrong on that. Mike has 4 of them, and he has a Sammy Bomb. And the Sammy Bomb, I'm going online doing a little research about it. Like, let's see how many more are out there, see if there's ever anybody's put them in slabs. There's no other ones out there. And there may be. Of course, you can never say it's the only one, but I could say that for all we know, it's the only one, or in all likelihood, it's the only one. And it's in beautiful condition. Some child or some young person took this and flattened it out, 70-some years ago, and put it in a scrapbook or wherever, and it's beautiful. It really is. And I describe our collectibles as beautiful, but it's breathtaking. And to look at it, to hold it, taking it out of the top loader to scan it, that was, you talk about nerve-wracking. You want to make sure that mm-hmm. you never know how the paper is going to act. And Mike had it. Obviously, Mike knew how to keep his collection archived, but I had to take it out and scan it, and was very careful with it, but just amazed how thin the paper was. So, that's just one thing. And then, I go in another box and start looking for some other things, and there's a complete set of Lake to Lake Packers, which I'm sure you're real familiar with.
Wow.
But, they don't come out very often.
Wow.
So, I sent a few of them off the PSA, and they're, the Bart Star, I can't remember exactly what grade it came. I think it came back in a 7. The last one that sold, I think, had a staple hole in it, and that was about 3 years ago. So, these are – it's just amazing to me, the completeness of it, his entire collection. It amazes me some of the things that he has. The care that he took putting the collection together, and how meaningful it was for him, and the meaning he put into it. It wasn't just accumulating. It was piece by piece, one thing at a time, working on sets. And I have some of his notes, and he shared some other things with me. A true collector. And the thing that I like most about Mike, and as far as, you know, the collecting standpoint, is he's never came off as being, you know, cutthroat or, you know, take somebody out of the league.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course, he was
competitive,
and he's told me that before, but for him, it stopped at that point. You know, if it had to get to that point where he was feeling that way, where this was superseding anything else he was doing in his life, and, you know, from the stories he told me, that was it. He's done. You know,
he's a classy man.
He certainly is.
And I think the big thing about Mike was, and again, knowing him from as many years as I have too, he always shared his knowledge, which was what I thought was so great about him. So you don't read about this stuff. You don't know anything about this stuff. You don't go to any catalog to find any of this stuff. Well, explain to me what you have, you know, and he did all the time, and it was great. And I think that's what's so, I don't know, for lack of a better term, perfect about the collection, because the collection represents that humbleness he has, and the collection represents the pristine nature of what he picked up, like you said, John, one item at a time. And that's what truly amazes me about his collection.
Without fear. And that's a good way to put it. You know, there's no fear involved. He wasn't afraid that somebody else was going to get this or that. He collected for fun, and he did it because he enjoyed it. And that's most.
So, John, in a total dick move, you texted me a progressive proof Steve Largent rookie card that Mike had in his collection. So I'm sure the entire audience is listening with bated breath, wondering what other Steve Largent collectibles Mike had in his collection. I mean, I speak to the entire hobby as a collective when I ask about Steve Largent items in particular.
There's absolutely nothing. In fact, those cards were all absent from the set. The Largents were all pulled out. He said something about you visiting the house one time. No, I haven't really looked. But yeah, I'm sure being in that area, he has there's plenty of stuff. And I did see the progressive proof, and that is in Wisconsin right now. But that stuff's all there, too. Yeah, he has a nice Washington Oregon standard collection as well, and those are some of the things that I think he kept. Yeah, I think he kept some of those things to himself, which is good. So,
and I'm stunned neither of you called me out when I said the entire hobby wants to know about the Steve Largent collection. I mean, come on, gentlemen.
We're still looking for Largent rookies here on the East Coast. I've had more people at shows ask me, "Would you have a Steve Largent rookie?" That's the only card I'm missing in my 77 set. And I said, "Well, I got a couple of beaters you can have. I'll try to get you a good copy. I know where there's about 20,000 of them in Oregon." So,
Joe, what is the number now? Do you have a tally?
You never disclose, but it's a little over 1,000.
That's fair. That's not compulsive or obsessive or anything. So that's good.
That's borderline obsessive. hey, pot me kettle.
Unbelievable.
I know. I'm bad too. Yeah.
John, if somebody wants to sign up for the auction or wants to contact you about consigning, can we have some information as to how they would proceed on that?
Sure, it's www.bst-auctions.com. That's the best way to get in touch with us, or mail at bst-auctions. You can also get in touch with us that way. Those are the best ways to do it. So we have been running a pretty...
John, I presume you put the S in BS?
Yeah, I certainly do.
And I believe also we have a link on Gridiron Greats Magazine website also, so you can go through there to check it out. All right, John, we're almost out of time. Any final thoughts on your end between either the auction and or the market? Anything else we should be looking for? Any other words of wisdom you can offer our audience tonight?
Just good to be back, and I'm glad. Thank you, Bob, for doing this, and Joe as well. And the hobby needs this, and I think this is in this day and age with everybody on the go all the time. It gives it some accessibility to, you know, I don't know if I want to call it knowledge, but I guess it is. You know, especially with the guests we have coming up. So it's a good thing, and I'm glad that we're doing this again. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for being on, and I appreciate it, and I'll let you go. I know you had a busy day all day today, and sit down for some supper, and you'll be all set. Thanks for being
on. Sounds good. See you,
guys. Good luck against KC tomorrow, Johnny.
Hey, thanks. Bye-bye.
That was John Spano our guest tonight, Jen, filling us in on some great information with regards to the auction and the market. And I want to go back to one other area that we talked about previously, as far as looking at a bubble versus actual appreciation of value. When we're looking at, you know, something like the collection at the Hall of Fame, and we're seeing all these different mm-hmm. types of cards and multiples of cards, on and on and on. And we also featured that as a super collector in the magazine a few issues ago, or last issue, whatever mm-hmm. it was. I found it kind of interesting to me that, okay, if I had, let's say I had $1 million extra for my collection, what would I do with that extra money? Well, in my opinion, I would go after all the oddball sets from 48 to 88 and then finish up the Bowman yeah. Large and the 50 Feltbacks and call it a day and say, I'm complete 48 to 88. Now, here's somebody with obviously has a lot of money to invest and spend in it and wants to have the what we can say is the best of the best of a collection. Okay, so again, will that collection hold its value in the future? And or B, is it contributing to the bubble of what's going on within the market today? And I personally think it's contributing somewhat to the bubble, but at the same time, it is healthy for the market because it is running up a lot of prices for everybody, you know. And I think that's helping the market to a certain degree and giving it a lot of press at the same time. But is the press positive mm-hmm. or is the press negative? You know what I mean? That's what we got to try to figure out as. You know, as we go along, try and understand what's going on with the market at the same time.
I think you're right on both set counts there, Captain. I mean, you know, it's good for the hobby, and it is a bubble. I mean, you know, if there's a, you know, for a PSA 9 Joe Namath card for, you know, whatever the price is now, $120,000, there's only a couple buyers out there.
Right.
You know, if the price is right, anyone will buy it. But the
right.
price has to be right for someone to sell. So, I mean, you know, there's only a couple people that can take a card like that down. And if one person leaves the hobby, you know, for whether it's federal indictment or a divorce or, you know, whatever, then, you know, you know, if there's three people who could take a card like that down and one of them leaves the hobby, the market just got very thin.
So
it's a self-created bubble.
I think that's also true with the Mayo set because, again, I've been waiting on and off. I'm still not finished with that set. And obviously, you know which one I need, the Dunlop, and it's got to be at my price type of thing because I'm just not tripped up spending that kind of money on it, number one. But number two, okay, so I spend it, I buy it, I got a complete set. That's another one that's going to go down to the bitter end. And is there going to be a market for, you know, how many years down the road type of thing? That's the other thing, you know, I always look at. Where's the market? Is there going to be a market? So on and so forth. Or can I just divorce myself from the market and just say to myself, hey, this is my collection. I've collected since 1965. I'll collect probably to the day I die. And that's it. You know what I mean? That's what you got to try to look at.
The only example... Yeah, the only example I would have of that is 1984 Tops is probably one of my favorite sets. Well, I used to want that number one set, and I used to spend a lot of time looking for PSA 10s. I wanted that set in all PSA 10. Well, at some point, three or four other people joined the fray, and next thing you know, you're paying $250, $300 for a Pop 2 or Pop 3 PSA 10 card. Yeah. And it just became prohibitive to the point where I was like, I'm done. So that was a bubble because once you got that Pop 2 card and you paid $300 for it, you know, a year later it was a Pop 4 and the card was going for $50. And 2 years later it's a Pop 10. So, I mean, that's a bubble. That makes it not fun for me. So I took a step back and said, I don't need this in PSA 10. When I look at a card that's a beautiful 9, the difference between a 9 and a 10 is such a fine thing. That I'm okay at 9. So I literally just had an epiphany on my own and just stopped and said, I don't have that big of an ego to the point where I want it in all PSA 10 and I want the highest grade set. I don't need to be known as 1984 Topps Joe. I stopped and I just went to PSA 9s and I still look at it the same. So to me, it's a hobby when it's enjoyable, when you don't lose, when you, when money gets involved, sadly, it sometimes
right.
stops becoming a hobby.
Right.
And I guess each
right.
person has their own, has their own.
And I tell you, that's where I lost a lot of steam collecting the newer tap sets just for trying to finish the run. And I was short the 13, 14, and 15 sets, and I made a couple trades. I got a bunch of cards from a friend, a mutual friend of ours, and I just said, I got to finish the run. I just got to get it done. And, you know, I just didn't have the excitement finishing that when I sleeved my last card of the 2015 in my 9-packet sheets and put it in a binder. It just wasn't there for me, you know what I mean? But again, I could pick up my 1960, you know, number 23 mm-hmm. set I'm making and just look at those cards. I could look at them for hours on end and read them, read the backs again and just thoroughly enjoy collecting that card, that set. So,
yeah,
and, you know,
set.
I hear what you're saying. I understand fully, especially with the set that you really relate to, an 84 tap set, you know, of your youth. And the same thing with me. With, you know, any cards from the 60s, I just thoroughly enjoy them one way or the other. All right, we're winding down real quick, Joe. Goal line stance, I'm handing off to you in 60 seconds or less. What did you learn on tonight's show?
There are some very good, classy collectors out there, and it is a small hobby. And I love our hobby. You know, there are some people who are very gracious collectors, and every once in a while you get to pull the curtain back and see what they got, and it's kind of cool. I learned that John Spano is a senior contributing writer, and I'm a contributing writer, so I've got a little bit of title envy there.
You gotta get those articles out. We need them. So
I do. Yeah, I guess that's where.
Gotta pump them out.
And I'm looking forward to what the next. You know, BST MSB auction has for you know, for selling the collection off. Mike's just like you said, he's got that once in a lifetime, once in a decade. Do you see that go down? I mean, there's a couple people with collections like that. I mean, it's Carl, it's, you know, Andy Becker.
Yep.
I mean, there's just certain people with collections of that caliber. And I don't even consider my collection to be of that caliber. It's just I'm a bystander when it comes to you know, monster collectors like that. So I love seeing it.
I agree. All right, we're on a 2-minute warning. Joe, any more thoughts?
Oh, Seahawks to the Super Bowl. Chicago National. I'll be seeing you there.
National.
I will be.
We're coming
I will
out
be.
Early.
I missed last,
we're gonna be
last
out
year.
There. We'll be out there the whole week. We'll be coming home Sunday. So hopefully I'll see a lot of old friends and readers of GG and check out all the very, very unique memorabilia we'll be seeing there. Maybe there'll be some new discoveries in the market. Who knows? Anything is possible as we go along. And I think it's going to be a different crowd than what we saw in Atlantic City. And
yeah.
It should be interesting, to say the least.
I didn't make it to AC. It's good
to be at any national show. It's good to see that stuff. It's great for the hobby. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I've missed the last two nationals, so we're looking forward to making it.
Good. Joe, we're going to be calling it quits now. I want to say goodnight to you, and I want to say goodnight to our loyal readers and listeners of Gridiron Greats Magazine and our podcast, where the legends of the gridiron will always live on. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back pretty soon with our next show. Thank you.
Ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.